is case number 85521, State of Nevada, Department of Business and Industry, Real Estate Division versus Alvin Mansour et al. Okay. Good morning. So as at least some of you have heard several times now, we're trying an experiment where we're giving 2 minutes of uninterrupted time at the beginning of each side's argument. And so you have that 2 minutes uninterrupted and then the 15 minutes we have traditionally given, so for a total of 17 minutes, but we will not interrupt you during the first 2 minutes. With that being said, counsel, would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
I guess I have time, 2 minutes, but not. If you have questions, I'll just go through
them. Sure. And so, as you know, then what will happen when you get to the 2 minutes is you'll get the yellow light and the tone, but the clock keeps running. With that, why don't you go ahead and begin?
May it please the court, Heidi Perry Stern on behalf of the State of Nevada Real Estate Division. The legislature in Nevada has made clear through NRS 645 that conducting real estate activities in Nevada, almost without exception, requires a real estate license. The underlying circumstances of this case are actually as simple as that. Petitioners sold Nevada real property or assisted others in selling Nevada real property without a license. And the division then investigated and brought a disciplinary action against them. The commission held a hearing and imposed fines on them. And honestly, this case could stop there. The petitioners never applied for a license, and they didn't even apply for the one narrow exception to licensing, which is an out-of-state certificate. We're here before this court today due to a misinterpretation and misapplication of NRS 645 by the district court. And that is a decision that I emphasize this court owes no deference to. It's contrary to both the plain language of the statute, it's contrary to the entire statutory scheme of real estate licensing in Nevada, and it's contrary to the legislative intent, both as expressed by the legislatures at the time of passage and as repeatedly emphasized by this court as it has interpreted NRS 645. The district court found that the out-of-state petitioners did not need a license to conduct real estate activities in Nevada. In essence, the court allowed one small provision of NRS 645, which permits commissions, to swallow the entirety of NRS 645, which requires a license, or in limited cases, a certificate. This decision upends the legislative intent and is legally erroneous, and we urge this court to reverse. So first, I'll start with the plain language. As I've noted, there is a narrow exception to licensing, and that's found in NRS 645.605. This is actually an expansion of opportunity for out-of-state brokers. It's not a restriction on them. It allows for particular transactions for out-of-state brokers to come in and to purchase Nevada real property. This legislative enactment also asked the or assigned the authority to the real estate.
Yep. 645.605, do you see that it is restricted to out-of-state brokers dealing with a Nevada broker for on the terms you just outlined?
I believe that comes into play in the regulation, which
so
is...
So it is not in the plain language of the
statute. That's true. The legislature did specify that the commission would be responsible for the conditions of issuance.
Yeah, but conditions, what does the word conditions mean?
Well, in our minds, it means under what circumstances will a license be issued? And I think it's important, Justice Pickering, in this regard, to recognize that a certificate is a single transaction document. And so the issuance of that certificate and the use of it in a transaction are coextensive. It's not a license where you can use that license for various transactions. The
Could the commission have passed a regulation that said under no circumstances shall an out-of-state broker transact any business to do with Nevada real estate or purchase and sale of property in Nevada?
Possibly, but I think that what the commission could have done is nothing. They could have just not made that available. I think that would have been the easier way. It would have been perhaps a little risky to expand what the legislature was saying and say, well, we're not going to do that because that is a bit of a conflict.
So you read this to give the division sort of untrammeled discretion to authorize out-of-state brokers' participation in Nevada real estate transactions. And they could have said, no out-of-state brokers can affiliate.
I don't understand your question, Your Honor. I'm sorry.
Okay. If they did nothing.
If the commission did nothing.
Yeah, where would they be?
Commission did nothing, you would require a license to participate in real estate transactions in Nevada. That's where we'd be.
So you would require a Nevada license?
Yes, yes.
So you think the commission had authority by doing nothing, and it did something, which is to allow this one narrow category of transaction, that meets what the legislature's done here?
I think it's more accurate to say that the legislature created the opportunity for this and that the commission specified under what conditions that opportunity would be available.
Okay.
Yeah. And you know, that is actually a common way for the legislature to work, as this court knows. The legislature decides what its intent is. It wants to, in this case, control the real estate transactions that go on in the state. It wants to oversee. It wants to ensure, as this court has recognized, the integrity, fair dealing, and honesty of these types of transactions. But it's not going to necessarily nitpick every single category. It says to itself, we want to control this, we want licensing. And then it says, but also, you know, we understand the practicalities of day-to-day real estate transactions. And so we're not going to specify specifically what that needs to be, but we will give the commission authority if in a practical day-to-day sort of situation they want to make an exception to this.
Ms. Stern, do you think that the Section 11, Subsection 11, violates the Dormant Commerce Clause to the extent that it may be discriminatory in purpose?
I would reference this court to the recent pork products case from the United States Supreme Court, which I think quite clearly, if what happened in the pork products case does not violate the Dormant Commerce Clause, we're nowhere near that violation here. And that, I will point out that interpretation of the Dormant Commerce Clause has been, as you know, upheld by the district court, in the United States District Court in this case, as well as the underlying court. Even the first JD here did consider Dormant Commerce Clause and just find it not applicable. So,
could you address the promulgation and adoption and the notice procedures and what in the record supports that they were by the 233 book for the adoption of subparagraph 11 in your regulation?
I'm going to, I have those printed out. Are you talking about 233B130 or?
185 subparagraph 11.
Oh, you're talking, okay, the administrator.
I want to talk about the notice and public hearings that were conducted on the adoption by the division of paragraph 11.
Yes, I can speak to that. I actually reached out to the client about that. And what had happened was it was treated in the exact same manner as subsection 1 as far as all of the requirements of 233B. However, there were no comments that were given back to them. They didn't get any public comments or complaints or any sort of just discussion of subsection 11. So that's why it doesn't appear as frequently as subsection 1.
Could we find a site that shows that was put out as a regulation being adopted with an opportunity for public notice?
I have that citation in my iPad.
That would be a help. Thank you.
Since I don't have Wi-Fi here, I will have to access it and provide it to the court. But we do, what we have in the record is the draft of that statute that was sent out, and it shows the language changes that were submitted for public comment.
Paragraph 1 or to
411. The whole thing. We submitted the whole thing. It's not like it was separated. I think there's a misimpression in the petitioner's brief that these were somehow treated separately. They weren't. It's just that the whole draft and changes of the entire section were submitted. It's not like we separated out subsection 11 and didn't submit it. It was submitted along with subsection 1.
But so there was a workshop done that
included
sub 11.
It was the same one. That's the thing. There wouldn't have been a separate one. It was the same one. So anything you can rely on to see that subsection 1 went through that process, subsection 11 was also included in that process. Because
it was my understanding that the agency was taking the position that it was a clarification and deliberately didn't include it in that process.
That is not my understanding from speaking to my client. They did tell me that they went through the entire process. I believe we also state that in our brief, but that because they didn't get comments back, it doesn't have the same record that subsection 1 has. And I'll get back to talking about the plain language of the statute and the legislative intent, and just talk a little bit about the error that the district court made here and that petitioners do somewhat rely on, which is there is a section 645.280 which allows commissions. But I would point out to this court that if you read the entire language of that section, it's also couched within a restrictive term. It's not that it allows commissions broadly. It states that in general, the general rule is Nevada licensed real estate agents can't share commissions. And then it makes that small exception for some out-of-state commissions to be given. So what the district court did was it allowed this small section, subsection actually, to swallow the entirety of 645. Because under the district court's order, it's now possible for out-of-state real estate brokers to practice without a license in Nevada in contravention of the entirety of NRS 645. So I'll address a little bit due process, and I would just point out to this court that due process requires notice, it requires the opportunity to be heard, and it requires fundamental fairness. And here, all of those things were available. There is no dispute that the petitioners did receive notice. They received a hearing. If you look at the complaints, you can see exactly the transaction that was found to be violative. They themselves acknowledged that they did not apply for either a license or a certificate. And finally, with regard to fundamental fairness, I think it's important that this court recognizes, with regard to the findings of fact and conclusions of law in the second hearing, the one in November 2020, that this was a remand order. There was limited opportunity for the commission to really consider this entirety of the case.
Well, they in fact just adopted the findings from the first hearing, correct?
They didn't even need to reconsider them. I mean, they did hear, they heard petitioners out, and they had a three-day hearing, but the restrictions of the remand were simply to consider the validity of the cooperative certificate program.
Well, isn't it problematic in your mind that the judge reversed the first hearing in part because of the inability of petitioners, or respondents here, I'm sorry, to present evidence and argument. And then the commissioners in the second hearing relied on factual findings from a hearing where one side was not allowed to present evidence and argument.
Oh, that vastly...
Maybe those factual findings would have been different had somebody been able to present evidence and argument.
With due respect, Your Honor, that vastly overstates the remand. The district court in that first, in the remand order, did not find that they were not able to present argument. It found that they were not, that they did not, or maybe were not able to, present argument on the specific issue of the cooperative certificate. And, you know, that's why I started my argument today the way that I did, because the cooperative certificate issue didn't come into effect.
I was flipping through a document.
Okay,
here.
Yeah.
I was looking at the first remand order, quote, the commission refused to hear evidence and arguments offered by petitioners.
Except that if you continue to read the entire order, it's not about what they did. It's not about the fact that they practiced real estate without a license. They definitely were able to present whatever they couldn't present anything because it's clear on its face that they didn't have a license and that they conducted real estate transactions. So the only thing to be considered in remand.
Procedurally, though, you don't think there's a problem with relying on factual findings from a hearing and where one side is found, in part, if I accept what you're saying, in part, present any evidence or argument. They were just foreclosed.
I respectfully disagree that that is what the remand order states. And I disagree that that's what happened as well as a factual matter. The remand order pretty clearly states that what is to be considered on remand is the validity of the certificate, the cooperative certificate program. There was no, and you'll notice during the remand hearing, again, there's no evidence that they didn't do exactly what was in the complaint. They don't really dispute that.
Well, looking at some of the transcripts of the proceedings, it does seem like there was an exchange between Mr. Rowe and the commission president, and he, you know, may I make an offer of proof? No, ask a question. I'll determine if you have any relevant testimony to give, and if you don't, we'll go to closing statements. May I ask questions regarding the harm to consumers from this? No. May I ask questions regarding the constitutionality of this? I told you what you can ask questions about, and in about 30 seconds, maybe 15, I'm going to closing statements. And it goes on.
Mm-hmm.
So it does seem like, you know, this testimony was substantially truncated. And
I don't know at that point what testimony they were going to enter, except for the harm that you mentioned. And harm is not relevant. Harm to consumers is not relevant to what was going on.
Isn't it one of the factors in evaluating the amount of fine to be imposed?
It can be if you're going to deviate from strictly just the amount that the real estate agent benefited, but that didn't happen here. It was just a numerical calculation here. They didn't, you know, you could, let's say, for example, in a hypothetical situation, somebody made $1,000 on a real estate deal but tricked 10 old ladies in doing it. Then you consider the harm to increase the fine and the penalty. Here, if you made $300,000 on the deal, it's one deal, you just add it up, and that's your fine. There's no need to consider consumer harm in that
case. What about Dormant Commerce Clause considerations? Were they not entitled to try to develop the facts with respect to that claim? And we have no offers
before the commission? Before the commission?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that, Your Honor. I wasn't aware that on remand they were considering the Dormant Commerce Clause. These aren't lawyers, you know, the commission members. So I think that that's something they had to bring in the U.S. District Court, which they did. That was really the forum for that to be decided. And they did do that. And they did that early on. They did that right away, as soon as they received the complaints from the commission. I am almost out of time.
You are completely and over time.
Oh, no, I'm over time.
Yes.
Well, can I say one sentence?
One sentence.
Thank you, Your Honor. I would just remind this court that it owes deference to the reasonable interpretation of the Real Estate Commission in this case and its interpretation of the statute it administers. Here, that means reversing the district court, and I thank you for your extra time that you allowed me.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you.
there some reason to think it isn't?
I don't know. Just because it's a couple times. They were surprised by it.
The timer is working on the podium there, right?
It's in 17 minutes in front of me.
Perfect.
Okay.
Let me start by introducing myself. I am Jill Rowe, counsel for the respondents. May it please the court. The real question at the heart of all of these proceedings is whether it's permissible for an out-of-state broker to transact real estate business in Nevada, so long as that out-of-state broker works up with, teams along with, cooperates with an in-state Nevada licensee. And the Nevada legislature says yes, that's permissible. It did so in NRS 645.280, where it expressly says it's okay for out-of-state and in-state brokers to share commissions on real estate transactions. Now, the Nevada Real Estate Division and Commission agree in part. They say, yes, it's okay to do that if you're representing an out-of-state buyer. But then they adopted this regulation and these mechanisms of discipline that say, but we're not going to do what the Nevada legislature said, fine. We're not going to allow you to share commissions if you're representing an in-state buyer, an in-state seller, or even an out-of-state seller. And so that's really what there's a whole bunch of issues in this case, but that's what it all comes down to. Now, why did the commission and the division adopt this regulation restricting the sharing of commissions in the first place? There's really only one piece of evidence. My client produced evidence, the state produced none. And it was the email from Jan Hawley, the guy who drafted subsection 11, and when he submitted that changes, his draft started to put it through the process, he wrote a cover email explaining why they were restricting the sharing of commissions. And he said, this interstate cooperative brokering activity is, quote, taking business away from our Nevada licensees. That's respondents appendix 205. So that's the reason we're here, because the real estate division and commission don't want to do what the legislature said, which is allow in-state brokers and out-of-state brokers to share commissions.
Ms. Rowe, do you agree they can require certification? Like if you're an out-of-state broker, that you can get a certificate?
Absolutely. I think that the legislature gave the commission the authority to say, if you want to require certificates, you may do so. What it didn't do was say you may restrict the use of those certificates to one slice of transaction.
But your client did not get a certificate.
That is true. It would have been, first of all, it would have been futile because the regulation and the form itself, the application said you cannot use a certificate if you're representing an out-of-state seller. And furthermore, the question here is whether this regulation is constitutional, whether it's in excess of statutory authority, whether it was adopted according to the regulatory process.
But rather than bringing that challenge, they just went on and conducted transactions without having any license or certificate in Nevada. Isn't that a problem?
It's really the only way they can do what the legislature said was okay, right? The only way that they could do it was they filed a lawsuit in the federal court to get it declared constitutional. The unconstitutional federal court said, come to the state courts. That's why we're here.
So, Ms. Rowe, I'm struggling a little bit to see how 645.280, which allows payment of a fee, gives any real estate agent the ability to work unlicensed in Nevada. I'm just missing a connection somewhere there.
It actually doesn't allow any real estate agent to work unlicensed in Nevada. If you look at the language of 645.280. So what that says, if you look at, you have to take the whole part of subsection 1, and it starts in subsection 1 by saying that you can't do it without a license. You can't do services performed by an unlicensed person. But the very next sentence clarifies that unlicensed person is referring to any license whatsoever. The very next sentence says, a licensed real estate broker may pay a commission to a licensed broker of another state. And there's only one way, commission, of course, is for providing the services that they were just talking about in the preceding sentences. So what it's saying is for instance, a California broker can't come in and not team up with a Nevada licensee. They have to do sort of a pro hoc vice, similar to what I'm doing with Mr. Fetter here. You have to work together cooperatively. You have to share a commission.
But in order for you to do that, you had to request permission to do that, which your clients did not do here.
The only reason you would have to request permission is because of the regulation, the NAC 645.685 subsection 11. That's the only thing that says that you have to do that. And that regulation, by restricting the use of the cooperative certificate, the use of the ability to share commissions, that's in excess of the section here in 645.280.
Well, so doesn't 605.605 specifically authorize them to adopt regulations regarding this subject matter and require certificates?
It did, but it said subject to the other provisions of this section. One of those provisions is that you must be able to share commissions unrestricted. And the other provision is that it says the only thing they can do is adopt regulations about the conditions of issuance and cancellation. And that goes to your question earlier. And I think when you look at the regulation that they actually passed, the subsection 11, it doesn't talk about conditions. It doesn't talk about the rest of that, the subsections 1 through 10, they talk about conditions of issuance and cancellation. Subsection 11 doesn't talk about conditions. It doesn't talk about issuance or cancellation. It talks about restrictions on the
use. So you acknowledge they can have the certificate requirement, the setup, the requirement to apply and give their information and their out-of-state license number and what have you, all of that information. It's only sub 11 that you think is not permissible.
That is correct. We believe they can require cooperative certificates so long as they make them available for all transactions.
And to be clear, in this case, were any of the transactions not conducted with a local Nevada-licensed real estate broker and a split commission?
No, every single transaction involved both. In fact, there were 13 transactions at issue. In 12 of them, in these cases, the local broker was disciplined as well. And the 13th one, the local broker wasn't disciplined because he wasn't brought up on charges for that one, but he was the broker of record.
This is sort of a little different issue, but we're talking about brokers and in-state brokers and out-of-state brokers. Are all of these folks who were fined in these proceedings brokers, or are some salespeople as opposed to brokers?
Some were brokers, some were salespeople. Really, we're talking about they're all working under the brokerage license of Marcus and Millichap.
Okay.
The in-house, in-house agents were all brokers.
Okay, I was just going to say 645.280 only authorizes a licensed real estate broker, which is Nevada, to pay a commission to a licensed broker in another state, not a licensed salesperson.
That's correct. And just as a technicality, it is in the record, but the way it works is the in-state broker, who are the people here, they pay the commission to the broker, and then the broker pays part of that to the agent, and part of it goes to the brokerage house, et cetera, et cetera.
But if you're reading this as the statute that allows a person who is unlicensed in Nevada to conduct real estate transactions, then how could we read that to allow somebody who is not a broker who was licensed in another state to work in Nevada?
I'm not 100% sure I'm understanding your question, Your Honor, but it's a quirk of real estate law that every real estate agent, whether there's a salesperson or a broker, they have to work under a broker of record, and it's the broker of record who technically is the broker and transacting the business, sort of like it's a little bit different in the law firm world, but it's like a corporation does X through its people.
What I'm saying is you're reading this statute to allow brokers licensed in other states to work in Nevada.
Correct. As long as they're working with a Nevada licensee.
But it only says broker. So how could somebody who is not a broker, who is not licensed in Nevada, work in Nevada?
What it says is you could share commissions with a broker. The only way a broker gets a commission is if its agent does the work. So it's sort of like saying you can pay a corporation. which allows the corporation's employees to do the work.
Okay.
And just other than the explanation that we want to keep the money in Nevada, has there been any other justification to restrict a broker's ability to not only represent a seller, but a buyer, and inside, outside of the state? I'm just trying to, I'm grappling with what the purpose of that is.
There was zero evidence of any other purpose, and that was the state, of course, the appellant's burden to produce that evidence. I did ask in the record, I asked the administrator, Mr. Chandra, you know, what's the reason for allowing it for out-of-state buyers and not allowing it for other types of parties, and he had no rationale for that. So there is no explanation. And to us, that's what brings in the arbitrary and the capricious nature of this, both under the Dormant Commerce Clause, but also when the appellant's counsel was asking you to give deference to them. You don't give deference if it's an arbitrary or capricious decision.
Ms.
You don't
Rowe,
give.
It would seem that you brought up Pro Hoc Vitae, and that was a note that I had made, because it seems like that. Because Pro Hoc Vitae allows a lawyer from out of state to not have to get barred here, but it's limited. So if somebody you can't just keep coming and getting Pro Hoc Vitae. At some point, you got to take the bar. On applying that application somewhat to this real estate context, if you let them represent essentially these Nevada transactions with an out-of-state license, they would never be incentivized to get a Nevada real estate license. They could essentially just be out-of-state Nevada real estate agents. And wouldn't that seem like a rational thing to address?
There are other provisions in NAC 645.185, similar to the one that you just said, which says you can get a cooperative certificate, but it's only going to apply for one transaction or a maximum of 12 months. I'm not here saying that if the commission chose to say to put different limits on the time limit, maybe they could. So I'm not saying that there needs to be unlimited use. Certainly, I think that reasonable regulation is appropriate under both the Dormant Commerce Clause and what the legislature intended. But what the legislature said here was, if you're going to adopt a cooperative certificate requirement, it said you need to make it available for all transactions.
And as far as you know, is this provision specific to Nevada? Does any other state have a similar type of a process?
Every state, to my knowledge, has sort of a Pro Hoc Vitae option. It is true that there are some states that on their books say you can't do it, but they don't enforce it. They allow it. There are different ways that people do it. Some people have limited licenses. Some people don't require any notification, or some states don't require any notification at all. So there's different ways that it does happen.
And it seems like there was something I was reading that said this has been the historical process in Nevada, and this just kind of codified what the process was prior to enactment of this.
That is the position that the appellant has taken, and you know, certainly we don't have the record evidence of that. But yes, well, I think what they have said is, hey, we have always been doing what I'm saying is unconstitutional and in excess of statutory authority. They say we just didn't get around to codifying it until 2016 when we made the change.
Can you comment on the compliance or non-compliance with the rulemaking process in the promulgation and adoption of subparagraph 11?
Yeah. The record is very clear that they did not comply with the rulemaking process for subsection 11. It is true that they said, here's the new change, but in that regulatory process, there's a whole bunch of things you have to do. Key among them is you have to tell the public and the legislative council and so forth the reasons for what the change is and how it's going to impact small businesses. You have to make clear the reason that you're doing this and what effect it's going to have. They did all of that for subsection 11. They did all of it for subsection 1. They did none of it for subsection 11. And to your point earlier, it seems to me pretty clear that they did that on purpose, that they didn't mention subsection 11 on purpose. It wasn't accidental. And how do I read that in? Because,
Was the text of subsection 11 put out to the public as part of the public workshop?
The text was put out, the text itself But the notice requirement that there's, and if you look at the things you need to include in your small business impact statement, in your statement to the legislative council, there's, these are all in the regulations and statutes. None of that was done. And the reason I say that I know it was intentional is because the day that the regulation was adopted, that very day in April of 2016, the division put out its open house newsletter, and for the very first time it said, by the way, we're not only changing number one, we also made this change to number 11, and they put it in plain English. They didn't ever put it in plain English prior to that. After.
Where's the record site for what you just said?
The record site for that is the open house newsletter. Which is at appellant's appendix, page 44.
Page 44?
I'm sorry?
What was the number?
Page 44 of the appellant's appendix.
Thank you.
And it says, it lists the whole regulation, and it says, clarification for use limited to representing an out-of-state buyer only, no representation of Nevada property owner or Nevada resident allowed. That language was absent from all of the other rulemaking process.
In the time remaining, could you respond to your colleague's discussion of the curtailment on the remand of the hearing?
I think it's absolutely incorrect. I was there. There were some proposed orders that went back and forth where the appellant asked for that tailored view of Judge Russell's remand order. He didn't give it. I think the other thing that's missing here is he said to remand it, let me put on my evidence, and I don't think he anticipated that the Real Estate Division and Commission were going to wait 20 months before they held the remand hearing. During those 20 months, three of the five commissioners turned over, and so we had a majority of the commissioners making these findings who weren't even there when the first proceedings happened, and there is no evidence of the record in the record that they ever read or considered any of the written record. They certainly didn't hear any of those witnesses.
What about she has a different view of the scope of the remand. Could you address that?
I think she's reading it wrong. If you look at the language of the remand order, he says, yes, I'm going to remand this, and when you make your new decision, make it consistent with what I said. One of the things he said in here was, hey, you got to let them put on their evidence, which they didn't. Another thing he said is, it appears to me that you've exceeded your statutory authority with this regulation.
Can I ask one more question?
Can I go first?
Oh, yeah.
Sorry. We still have questions. I'm looking at the remand order and the last page of it, which is at page 2260 of appellant's appendix. So, which is the order part of the order, right? It's ordered, adjudged, and decreed. The division's dismissal motions are denied. Paragraph 28. The decisions are set aside and remanded to the commission with instructions to, one, hear petitioner's evidence and arguments with respect to whether the cooperative certification regulatory framework exceeds the commission's statutory authority and or violates the U.S. Constitution, goes on, two, determine the validity of the cooperative certification regulatory framework, and three, apply that determination, that is, regarding the validity of the cooperative certificate regulatory framework, to the decisions consistent with this order. So doesn't that seem to say that the purpose of the remand is to evaluate the validity of the cooperative certificate program and then, you know, see how that affects the decisions made?
I have two responses to that. One, I think that he was definitely saying you need to do these things. I don't think that means that he said you don't also need to consider other evidence. And again, I'm going to focus on this very key difference that I don't believe Judge Russell anticipated. 20 months passed between the initial proceedings and the remanded proceedings. And when the new remanded proceedings happened, a majority of the commissioners were brand new. They hadn't seen any of the evidence. And so I don't think Judge Russell, I think maybe if you'd had the remand proceeding the next day, somebody could argue that it was duplicative. The same commissioners had already just heard some of the evidence. We don't need you to duplicate evidence. But with a majority of the commissioners now brand new, I think that's a whole new case where commissioners were adopting wholesale these conclusions. And I think when you look at the decision, and we haven't talked about this, but it's really important, when you look at the decision that was submitted ex parte by the prosecutor to the commission president, it had nothing to do with what the deliberations at either of the proceedings were. It was clearly just designed to protect it against petition for judicial review. The prosecutor wrote up the prosecutor's own view of what a finding was on everything I had requested. The prosecutor wrote that up, gave it to the commission president, no indication the rest of the commission ever saw it. I didn't see it. I didn't even know until Judge Russell started asking very direct questions at the hearing that this is what had happened, that the prosecutor had drafted it, prepared it, sent it over to the commission president who had rubber stamped it and signed it. So I think there's just no evidence that the commissioners actually even considered the evidence or deliberated on the findings that were purportedly made in this decision that was drafted by the prosecutor.
Okay, Justice Weeded, you still have
it. No, your question addressed it. Thank you. Okay.
Thank you.
And, thank you.
You know, in light of the extra time, I'm going to give Ms. Stern 1 minute for rebuttal.
I'm not even going to use my extra time to rebut, but I did want to provide an answer to Justice Pickering's question with regard to the record citation of the compliance with 233B. I think the best place to find that is in the respondent's appendix. There is the deposition of Jan Hawley, and attached to that deposition are several documents that show first the draft language, which includes subsection, includes the whole section. Specifically, that's found at respondent's appendix 212. But there are also surrounding documents that show how it was workshopped and submitted. So that's all I have.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
All right.